21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Oh, how is it that I could come out to here and be still floating and never hit bottom and keep falling through, just relaxed and paying attention?
You're listening to the birds. Yes, that's right. You are B-Y-R-D-S. Not all the birds that are in our backyard, but singing birds. And this is 21st Century Radio. And tonight, we're talking about disclosure of UFO reports by the military and government officials and the best of 2018 sightings. Especially, your job is to go out. You don't even have to go out. You can order the book, UFO Cases of Interest. It's in the 2000. This is the 2019 edition. 2018's best reports from the field investigators of Mutual UFO Network, and good old Roger Marsh, who deserves two or three PhDs for this particular book. He is the editor. The case overviews, report statistics, and research index. You need to get a copy of this one. It's extremely important. And, of course, our guest is Jan Harzen, who's basically going to tell us a little bit about the video of the triangular UFO in Maryland. Now, I understand this was in Carroll County, Maryland. Manchester is in Carroll County, Maryland. What can you tell us about this exciting witness sighting?
Well, this witness was around midnight, 11:57 p.m. on March 10th, 2018. He just noticed some lights as he was sitting inside his house out of the corner of his eye and went outside to look through the trees, and he saw this craft flying overhead with some lights on it, and it got a short videotape of the craft itself. So he couldn't hear much. Perhaps it was silent, and it just continued flying in a pretty much straight direction. Now, I would say this. I mean, it's always a possibility when you have something of this nature that it could have been an aircraft, some kind of an aircraft, but aircraft have certain configurations on the lights. In other words, you know there's a red and a green light on the wingtips. The green goes on the right side. The red goes on the left side and the green on the right side. That's what you can tell what the aircraft is headed. And then it usually has a collision light, which is bright white, blinking at about 1 second, so that aircraft can stay separated from each other. But obviously this witness didn't believe it was an aircraft. They watched it, observed it, did a little research on the internet, came up with some information on the B-2 bomber, which is triangular shaped, and the TR-3B, which is out there in the news, and reported it to MUFON.
Well, I'm glad they did, because we're not that far from Manchester in Carroll County. And we didn't.
Yes.
We heard nothing about it. Nothing at all about it. That's what I mean by
that.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, that's the thing. You know that these things rarely make it into the newspaper or into the local news. We've tried to take the best cases and reach out to the local media, to let them know, hey, you should know there was a case in your area. Typically, they want to talk to the witnesses, and of course, we leave that totally up to the witnesses because we keep their names confidential. But if someone does reach out to us from the press and they would like to speak with a witness on this particular case, we will reach out through the field investigator to the witness and say, hey, there's, you know, KFWB in, you know, Cincinnati or whatever it is, wants to speak with you on record. Sometimes people will do that. Sometimes they don't want to do it. So, and I completely understand. So we leave that totally up to the witnesses.
Well, the next case is in New York. A witness describes hovering diamond-shaped UFO of all places at Woodstock. How do you like that?
It was there for the concert.
Yeah, of course. Of course they were there for that. As a matter of fact, I understand that Jimi Hendrix must have thought of something about, you know, Hendrix had some UFO sightings.
And yeah, well, a number of rock stars have seen UFOs, so it's not uncommon for, and actors, famous actors, Kurt Russell, who went to high school, I went to high school with him, or he went to high school with me, I'm not sure which, he was a senior, I was a freshman, saw the Phoenix Lights, he actually witnessed that, so, and reported on it, so It's not just Billy Bob in the backwoods seeing these things. These are like pilots, astronauts, incredible people, doctors, lawyers, actors, movie stars. So, yeah, it's definitely a worldwide phenomenon that's definitely cuts across all sectors of the human race, for sure.
And that's fairly interesting you said that, because years ago, when I painted this bus that went up to Woodstock, I had no idea that Woodstock would end up being bigger in Europe, China, Japan, many, many other countries, more so than in America.
Because yes.
Felt, if you went to Woodstock and you, this is the way it used to be, if you went to Woodstock and you went to, say, somewhere in the United Kingdom and you shared that information with somebody, they would be giving you free meals. They would be paying for where you were staying. You were a celebrity, right? A big celebrity to them, because
right.
they felt that that was the time when we basically could bring together almost 500,000 people, and there were no fights. There was no killing. One person died because a tractor ran over him, and another person died from some type of drug. But that was it. Out of 500,000 people, that is extraordinary.
And, absolutely.
And the Woodstocks that came after that in 94 and 99 were never anywhere near as good as the first one. There was something going on at the time in 1969 yep. that people really felt it was time we had to have peace and love. And regardless of how it looked to other people, that's really what was going on there. No fights. It's amazing to have that.
I mean, it was amazing.
Imagine if they would have had whiskey and beer.
Or the internet. I would make it akin to the Storm Area 51 stuff going on with all these people, hundreds of thousands of people saying, "Oh, I'm going to go do this." I highly advise against it, of course. But yeah, it's just people. It just hits a chord, like you say. Woodstock hit a chord with people, and 500,000 people showed up out of nowhere, literally.
Well, the next one. It's on page 53. It's called the March. It's called the Irish Witness says Kraft body seemed to breathe. I'd love this because there was a time period about a couple of decades ago when things were coming out, the ideas that you know the way the UFOs were driven were really by beings that actually their hands would touch things, but they. That's how they maneuver their vehicles, so to speak, which was very, very interesting to me from that perspective.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Let's see. Now, could you tell us a little bit about this? This craft body seemed to breathe. I'm trying to remember what shape this craft was. First, on page 53. Let me check this out again.
Yeah, I'm trying to check that myself. But, basically, and this is what's interesting, you know, many of our cases start out this way. Either they went out to walk their dog, or they went out on the back porch to have a smoke, and then they observed something. So we've determined that, you know, if you want to see a UFO, you have an 80% increased chances if you smoke and walk your dog. Well, you've got to be outside, obviously, and that's what takes people outside, and then they look up at the sky. But this one has a very interesting write-up. You know, he said that it was a size. Decided to take my dog for a walk around the local football field. I guess he called it pitches. The witness said he put his phone on charge and left the house at approximately 5:20. Brought his dog along and bent on one knee to take the dog off the leash when he. Looked up and saw a large black craft passing silently over his head from behind. It did not fly normally. It sailed or glided. So it was very quiet. It was silent. Made no sound. Didn't even break the air. Craft was well below the cloud level, and he could almost reach out and touch it. So it was very, very close to him. He said the object was captivating, which means that he was, like, just staring at it in awe, like we were when we were kids. So I don't remember standing, but I must have done so as I followed it directly underneath it. It was triangular in shape.
All triangular.
There were zero edges on the craft. That's interesting in and of itself. In other words, it wasn't sharp edges. There were just probably rounded edges. Its side and form were perfectly smooth and precision perfect. Yeah, that's when we start thinking these things might be of extraterrestrial or non-human construction, because these perfectly smooth surfaces. I could see patterns on it, like the skin of a reptile. It's hard to describe, but it looked like it was plated, except without rivets or any noticeable joints. It was perfectly smooth in all directions, like a layer of black skin. There were three orbs at each point of the craft, and then the orb on the right, the forward orb and the right orb were static and did not pulse. The orb on the left was pulsating. So it's interesting. You know, it's kind of like, it kind of felt, it was almost like a breathing organism of sorts,
right,
that was going over his head.
Yes, that's really interesting to me, because there might be more to this than it just looking like it's breathing. Which obviously there's so much more that we need to learn about these craft. Now, one of the things that have excited me more than just about anything on the planet of UFOs deals with the ones that come in submarine shapes. Now, on page 80, it is a Washington UFO described as submarine with rectangular edges. So it's not one of those smoothies. Could you tell us a little bit about this guy?
Well, he was watching a brown metal object that looked like to him to be a submarine, but had rectangular edges, as you mentioned. He was watching, actually, it happened at near sunset, 8:30 p.m. on May 25th of 2018. That's what I can see from the report. The intensity of the sunlight made it shine and revealed shadows indicating layers of metal. It was submarine-shaped, only with sharper rectangular edges defining its exterior. It did not have any intake openings for a jet engine, and it did not have any propellers or jet engines, so it made no noise. It flew silently and fast. So this was kind of a rectangular, long, tubular kind of a craft moving across the sky, which doesn't make much sense because there's no wings seen on it. There's no control surfaces. It's just basically a large submarine-shaped rectangle.
Well, one of the reasons why I'm so interested in submarines and they're going in water and that kind of thing is because we wrote a book on the Beatles' Yellow Submarine, and we're working on part two. And one of the things that excited me back there in 1993 is a UFO filmed over Stuttgart in May of 1993 looked exactly like a submarine. It probably wasn't, but it looked just like it. And, you know, one of the great things, there are so many great symposiums MUFON has put on. But I got to tell you, the one symposium of 2017 has got to be, to me, one of the greatest you've done. This dealt with the case for secret space programs and things of that nature.
Right.
But it also had some really interesting submarine-type kind of craft.
Yes, that was Bill Tompkins.
Yes, correct. Bill. Oh, boy. That, you know, did you run out of copies of this book, The Case for the Secret Space Program? Did you ever?
Oh, yeah. It was our biggest success ever from the standpoint of putting on a conference. There's just so many people who wanted to attend it. It set all sorts of records. We got a little bit of gas because we had some speakers on it that people felt were not viable. But, you know, how do you prove someone's not telling the truth? It's very difficult. You can't. If someone is lying, then definitely we wouldn't have them on as a speaker. But if they have information they believe to be true, we felt that we wanted to provide a forum for discussion on the case for a secret space program. In other words, what do people think about that? And we had scientists. We had James Woodward, who wrote books, we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but a book on spaceships and starships and wormholes and how we might go interstellar one day. We had some top-notch researchers. I mentioned Michael Schrat already, Mark McCandlish and others. And then we had kind of the other site, which is kind of like this 20 and back program, to Mars and back. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, I have no way to prove it. But we looked at the whole field and kind of put it all out there, and then people could make up their own minds. MUFON's not really in place to tell people how to think. we're there to provide them with the data and help them think. So,
well, that's what I
that's what we did in that program.
That's one of the reasons why I love MUFON. I mean, you know, by providing all this information, let us make up our minds about this. And
right.
Now I'm being told right now that I have to make up my mind to take a break here on 21st Century Radio. Obviously, I have to pay attention to what goes on from my boss in there. So let's take a break here. Well, our guest, Jack Harzen. And Jack, how did you ever get that name? Of course, it's Jan Harzen, not Jack. We're talking about disclosures of UFO reports, etc., and especially about the UFO cases of interest, an edition of a book that tells you about these best 2018's best reports and a lot more than that. We'll be back soon.
Wild rumors have spread across the country that the Earth has been invaded by men from Venus. Such reports are absolutely false. Should any information concerning the arrival of men from outer space be confirmed, we would, of course, report this immediately.
Hi, this is Bud Hopkins, UFO investigator and writer and artist, and you're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus, 21st Century Radio, and I'm very pleased to be a guest here.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest Jan Harzen, Executive Director of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. And we're going to talk about one more sighting here on page 149. August 27th, a Nevada witness describes an entity as wings and no face. This really is fascinating to me. As a matter of fact, the illustration for this is on page 129, where you can see this incredible situation. What can you tell us about this?
Well, first, it was reported by a witness who, a former military and currently works in law enforcement. So you have to take the credibility of the witness as being very high in this case. But we do get cases of entities reported to us, just beings. Many times it's truckers late at night on dark roads going down, and they'll claim something runs across the road in front of them, and they catch it in their headlights, which I think is what happened to this guy. He's not a trucker, but he caught this in his headlights about 4 a.m. in the morning, and it kind of shook him up a bit. So we do get these reports of beings, you know, winged creatures and different things, which is very, very strange, but it's probably no stranger than some of the UFO craft we see either. So we take the reports, and actually, I should tell you this, Dr. Bob, we actually revamped our case management system. So when people report a sighting to MUFON, which they can do by going to MUFON.com and clicking on Report a UFO up at the top corner, on the right top corner, they actually are immediately presented with a screen that says, what would you like to report, a UFO, an abduction, or an entity? And you can actually click all three. So you could have perhaps seen a UFO, were taken aboard the UFO, and maybe saw an entity on the UFO. But we did that purposely to break out the question set so people could report different things to us, because what we'd like to start doing is reporting what we're finding with regard to these abductions and or entity sightings, and what the witnesses are telling us in terms of what impact it's having on them personally and what they've been told as part of those cases. So this would be an entity sighting that this individual had, and they're quite unusual. And people really scratch their heads over him. But, I mean, there's no reason to doubt that this guy is telling us what he actually saw.
This kind of reminds me of Mothman.
Yes, exactly.
Especially, you know, because the wings. You know, it's quite extraordinary. It really is. And I think that I've always been more interested in the beings that are driving, if you can call it driving.
Flying
these things.
Controlling.
And yes, because that to me seems to be the heart of the situation when you get to these actual beings. And there's so many different types. Remember the days, not decades ago, when we thought there were only maybe two or three different types and then four different types? They got it up to 56 different types. Then they went way beyond that.
Well, when you think about it, there's trillions and trillions of planets out there that probably could, well, I don't know how many could harbor life, but there's trillions of planets out there for sure, certainly, but just trillions upon trillions. Yeah, and if life, course, the blueprint for life seems to be out in the universe, and it seems to be, you know, bipedal, 2 feet, 2 arms, a head. But we look very differently, or they look very, very differently, depending on where they're from. So, yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think, you know, people were pushing for more information out of this whole ATIP program, but their whole program was built around trying to figure out what these objects were and how they worked. That was really what they wanted to know. But the whole field of study beyond that, which is, you know, where are they from, why are they here, and who are they, right? Who are they, what, where are they from, and why are they here? And then that's something that we are working on within MUFON through our experience or research team and Kathy Martin and her team, George Medich and folks. And we're trying to collect all that data from all these different instances that people are telling us interactions they're having with non-human entities and try to figure out exactly what's going on. And it might be multiple things. It might not be any one thing, but it is fast. I think it's fascinating.
Oh, sure is. It sure is. It keeps me up late at night.
Hopefully a good way.
Well, that's the best time to read some of this stuff as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Being an artist, I just love the idea of the energy area thing there. Well, there are scores and scores more of these different experiences and cases, and we could take time to do more of them, but let's talk more about MUFON itself now. Can you elaborate on some of the current goals of MUFON, such as reaching out to universities? Boy, that's extremely important. What can you tell us about the connections to UCLA and Cal State Fullerton, and is MUFON sponsoring research?
Absolutely. You know, it if you just collect the data and you put it in a database and never touch it again, it's not all that useful. But if we could get our scientists and, like I said, engineers, psychologists, and sociologists and others to actually take this data and use it for something good. And the one thing I'm thinking of is, well, you mentioned energy, but just propulsion. Propulsion, energy, and communications, those three areas. And there are people looking at some very, very esoteric types of things. And one of them is in the area of faster-than-light propulsion. There's a group of 40 to 50 scientists, both theoretical and experimental, around the world. And they are part of a group that communicates regularly over a little email chain that James Woodward, who is a professor of retired professor from the Cal State Fullerton, put together. And he's actually sponsored, he along with the Space Studies Institute and Gary Hudson have sponsored each year up at Estes Park, Colorado. And they had invited me to come up and speak. Now, I should say, first off, James Woodward, he's an experimental physicist. His PhD is actually not in physics, but he works in physics and is working on a thing called Mach effect, which is a byproduct of Einstein's general theory of relativity that basically says that you can create inertia through mass. And he's done that quite well to the point where DARPA is actually helping fund some of the research. So now that's one thing. There's an M-drive, which is something NASA was working on through its Eagle Works group, which is a resonant frequency in a cavity, which looks very much like a nozzle of a rocket. This seems to produce thrust. And none of this is working based on Newton's action-reaction. It's just basically these things are causing motion where they probably, what we've been told is they shouldn't be, but they are. And then, of course, there's a whole thought process behind Einstein's general theory of relativity, which says that there's a way to manipulate space-time, and so you can actually move from here to there by this manipulation of space-time. That's a whole other area, which Hal Puthoff, anyway, believes that's how these craft are actually getting here, is they're ripping small holes in space-time, and they're crawling through those holes. So I had the opportunity to go up to Estes Park and be a fly on the wall while these guys talk to each other. I would love to tell you I understood everything they said, but most of it was mathematical equations, and even though I have a degree in engineering, nuclear engineering, I my eyes glazed over a lot, but they did talk about different possibilities. And afterwards, I was able to present to them a number of our better cases from MUFON, and I was pleased to say that they all showed up for my presentation, and they're all fascinated by it. I'm not saying they all agreed with it or didn't agree with it, but these are the kind of people we need to be talking to about this information and getting it to them. A number of them have picked it up and have called me since then and asked for additional information, putting them in touch with witnesses who are willing to talk to physicists, you know, on the record, off the record. But through doing this, I think we're going to have tremendous breakthroughs in not only propulsion, but energy systems. And I do believe communications as well, because Einstein had said that he called it spooky action at a distance. There have been a number of experiments done where they tweak an electron over here, and then somewhere miles away, it's paired electron has an instantaneous movement, which says somehow that information was transported from this spot, you know, thousands of miles away to another spot, and it actually happened instantaneously. In other words, there was no delay based on the speed of light. So we're learning quite a bit about our universe and how it's built. One of the fascinating things is I had the opportunity to go up to Cal State Fullerton to Jim's lab and spend the afternoon with him, and he was showing me his experiment and actually took me through how he was using this Mach effect. And as we were sitting there talking and showing me his oscilloscopes and his setup, his experimental setup, he turned to me and he said, "Jan, you know, sometime 100 years from now," and he paused and he said, "Well, no, maybe 20 or 30 years from now, possibly," he said, "you'll be able to have a watch device on your wrist, and you'll be able to put in a place and a time and push a button, and your own personal wormhole will open up, and you'll step through that wormhole to that place and time, space and time, I guess, is what it would be." And I thought for a second. I said, "Well, Jim," I said, "if that's true, you've just explained most of what UFOs are about, because they appear to show up out of nowhere, and they disappear into nowhere." Mm-hmm. And people say, "Well, because it didn't leave any physical trace, it couldn't be." But that's fascinating, really, and it's all based on Einstein's general theory of relativity. So I think 100 years later, we're finally getting our heads around what he came up with back in, 1919 or thereabouts, in terms of this general theory of relativity. And it has to do with how our universe and how our universe is constructed, and it's all mathematical, which I find fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you know I had a conversation with Ben Rich many years ago, and he spoke at a UCLA alumni event for engineers.
Would you tell us a little bit about this great, great guy, Ben Rich?
Yeah, Ben Rich was the, at the time he was retired as the chief executive officer of the head of the Lockheed Skunk Works, which of course builds all the top secret spy planes, everything from the U-2, the SR-71, up to the F-117, which by the way was first flown in 1983. And we've seen nothing else announced out of the Lockheed Skunk Works since then. That was almost 5, 6 years ago. That would tell you that there's something they've been working on. I'm sure they haven't been just sitting there watching movies at the Lockheed Skunk Works. I'm sure they've created quite a few things. But he actually mentioned that during his talk to the engineers at UCLA, where he had graduated from, he talked about the fact that the stealth fighter was built based on a Russian mathematician's equations. And the engineers at the Lockheed Skunk Works picked up those equations and decided that the way to build a completely invisible aircraft to radar would be by using this mathematical. That's why the F-117 looks so strange. It's so angular. It's got all these different shapes to it and angles to it that a normal aircraft doesn't have. It's to evade the radar. Well, similarly, he mentioned that we've figured out how to go travel to the stars, and it won't take us our lifetime to do it. And it's all based on a set of mathematical equations. Now, he wouldn't share with me what those mathematical equations were, but my great sense is that now, many years later, they were talking about Einstein's general theory of relativity, and there were some errors in that. And Hal told me that they'd figured out what those are.
You mean Einstein?
Theoretically.
Did you say Einstein made some errors?
Well, there were errors in those equations. There were some things. And I've read many, many years ago that he may have purposely made those errors because he was afraid that if he had written it the way it was supposed to be, that we would have taken those and turned them into weaponry, and he didn't want that to happen. He saw what happened to his E equals MC squared where we started building atomic bombs, and I think he was concerned about it. Now, that's all hearsay. I mean, who knows? Einstein's not here to tell us why he did what he did. But the good news is that all these physicists who are studying this are now starting to come to the realization that we can manipulate space and time, and in doing so, we can get to places where we thought it would take us eons to get there.
Now, would you tell us about the new initiative at MUFON called The Greatest Questions? This sounds very exciting, like a highbrow think tank for UFO mysteries.
Absolutely. Well, that and research. Well, Dan Wright, who is a former director of investigations and took some time off from MUFON, came back about a year or 2 years ago and opened up a dialogue with me, and we were talking. He had really two great interests. One was all these CIA papers at the time that had been dumped on the Internet, and asked me what we were planning to do about it. And I said, I don't know, Dan, what should we do about it? So he came up with a whole thing, and he actually went through and culled through all these documents, and we wrote a book called The CIA Papers, which was published through MUFON Books, now also available on Amazon for you, which talks about all these papers that supposedly the CIA dumped out of. You know, it was back when they were trying to say, oh, we've given you all the information on UFOs we have in our files, which I highly doubt, but that's what they said. And so this book is about what they dumped out onto the Internet. But in passing the same thing, he really wanted to re-energize our research consultants and folks who we've always had consultants in MUFON. They're the people with PhDs and master's level degrees to work on cases. And we've kind of, it's always been more in name than actually in actual practice. And so what he wanted to do is energize these PhDs. We have about 300 PhDs identified in MUFON, people with either a PhD or master's degrees. And so he came up with the 25 greatest questions. And they're just, you know, great questions because of the whole UFO phenomenon that people would want to know answers to. I'm going to try to pull up some of these questions for you.
While you're pulling up the great questions, we'll take this break so that you won't be interfered with. And that. So let's take a little break here. Jan Harzen is going to put together the great questions for us when we come back.
Hi, I'm Bruce McAbee, UFO investigator of many years and author of the book The UFO FBI Connection. And you are listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio.
Oh, there's Uncle Bruce McAbee. He's moved away from Baltimore. He's somewhere out in the middle of the country. We sure do miss him. Boy, we had some good times and parties with him. Go out there looking for UFOs with Bruce was just so much joy for many of us. Our guest has been a great joy tonight, Jan Harzen. And he's the executive director of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. And we've been talking about disclosure of UFO reports by the military and government officials, etc. But we're now getting to something that I think is extremely important, and it deals with the great questions. Could you review how these great questions and who gave them to us?
Yeah, absolutely. These were Dan Wright, former director of investigations for MUFON back in the 80s, 90s, and he approached me after he'd taken some time off, as many people do sometimes because they get burnt out on the whole UFO question. We took some time off and came back and said, you know, we really should look at our PhDs and our masters now that the disclosure has happened. I consider disclosure having happened, that might be more willing to work on some of these questions. So he came up with a list of 25 questions, and we can talk about a few of those, but we then basically went out to our membership and said, hey, if you're a PhD or master's, they have the capability to let us know that in their profile as a member. I don't know if you remember in the old days, Walt used to have a form you'd fill out and you would tell what your skills were. We now have that all automated. It's all online. It's through a membership system that when you join, you actually get access to. So we have nearly 300 PhDs and master's level people that have identified themselves to us. So we could have more, but those are the people who have identified themselves to us. And so we sent out an email to them about 2-3 weeks ago just saying, hey, we've got this program we'd like you to participate in. And we've got these questions. Now, there may be other questions, and so we did encourage them to send any other questions they could think out to us. And the request was if they had an interest in a specific question or set of questions, up to five, that they would write a thesis on it. It didn't have to be long, maybe 3, 4, or 5 pages, and submit it. And then we would kind of combine these together and then create little working groups, if you will, for people to have discussions on these different points. So Let me just take the first one, which was despite the scientific paradigm that the speed of light cannot be exceeded, if you recall my comments at the beginning where I said, you know, 100% of the people believe there's life out there, but 50% of them believe it's never been here.
Yeah.
Part of that is because there's this belief out there that the speed of light can't be exceeded. So it says, despite the scientific paradigm, the speed of light cannot be exceeded. Is faster than light travel by an anomalous object somehow possible? If so, what would that entail? Well, we spent a little bit of earlier part of the show talking about this work that's going on with all these physicists on faster than light travel. But this is one, like, it's something that we're very quickly coming to an answer on, and it may have to do with space-time manipulation. But, you know, it'd be good to start getting all the great minds together to go start working on these issues. So that's just question number one. I can go through a couple others.
Oh, yes, I think you should, because I think we have a pretty good audience here that's been with us for about 30-some years, and some of them are very well-educated, Hopkins graduates and things of that nature. So I know that they might be interested in stuff like this.
Yeah, and I would encourage anybody who's listening who has an interest in this to reach out to they can contact me at exe.dir@mufon.com, and I can put them in touch with Dan. But the next question here was, how can an apparently structured craft of substantial size, we talked about 1,000-foot crafts up there, move at great speed through Earth's troposphere, or just say atmosphere, without leaving a sonic boom? Now, this has been one of the great questions. Like, these things go from a standing stop to instantaneous acceleration, shooting off into space or wherever they go, but there's no sound. It's like it doesn't even leave a ripple. And we know that our jet aircraft flying through the, if they get above a certain speed, that we have that sonic boom that happens. So what are they doing that we don't know about? Here's one that really interests me. Well, episodes of extreme acceleration or deceleration or sharp turns. Now, we see that all the time. These instantaneous from a standing start to all of a sudden hypervelocities or making a quick right angle turn. What would counter the effects of inertia on the occupants? In other words, why aren't the occupants just totally smashed against the walls when they do this? I think we're going to find that it has to do with, again, space and time manipulation, and perhaps in their inertial constraint or time frame or framework, they're not actually moving. Everything's moving about them. But we'll have to figure that out, and it's going to come out of answers as we study this in much more detail. There's one here about auto engines, question 9, actually. An auto engine quits in the presence of a UFO. What would cause it to do this and to spontaneously restart when the anomalous vehicle leaves? It's almost like there's a car running down the road, all of a sudden this object shows up and it just stops, it stalls.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the object leaves, it starts right back up like nothing had happened. It's almost like did space-time stop or something, and then it went back to its previous space-time. It's very, very strange. I mean, we wouldn't be able to, if our car engine quit, of course, unless you have a hybrid engine, you wouldn't be able to restart it normally without turning the key or doing what you need to do to start the engine.
Right.
So
sure.
There's some here about the beings themselves. Let me just scroll down here a little bit. You know, if certain entity types are not biological in nature, would it follow that they have exceedingly long lives? Is life even a correct term? So we're talking about sometimes these beings don't look like they're actually biological. They look like maybe they're, what would you say, just drones of sorts? I mean, So does that mean they could live forever because they're not biological?
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps they've figured out how to live eternally, or maybe not, or maybe they just live 1,000 years. It'd be interesting to see from the human race if we lived more than the 75, 80 years that our lifespan tends to be, or even say 100 years, would we change the way we operate on the planet? Because wisdom usually comes with age, and most of us are dead by the time we get it, so we could if we could have a little more wisdom on this planet, some of the things we're doing.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, please continue. I love these questions.
Oh, yeah, they're great. Yeah, so here's one. This has always been one that I've wondered about. No entity has been observed eating or drinking.
That's a good one.
If there is no such intake, what are the biological implications? Like, how do you survive if you're not taking in food or water? We think of it the way human body works. Perhaps these beings use some other way to fuel themselves or to continue to exist. That's always been one that's fascinated me, too. You don't ever hear of an abductee saying, oh, I went on board the craft and they were sitting there having dinner together.
No, more that they even had restrooms on it.
Yeah, they were restrooms, right, exactly. Yeah. And it's always very clean. The craft is always very clean, and it's always lit by lights that are not visible. Mm-hmm. It's just like it's just lit. It reminds me, biblically, of when God made light, but he didn't create the sun and the moon until a few days later. So we think of the light that we see coming from the sun, but if you didn't have that, how would you have light? Or if you walk into a room, how is a room lit, but there's no light bulbs anywhere visible? So these are questions that are kind of confounding, and hopefully will lead us into some breakthroughs that will help all of us here. Oh, here's a good one, too. I think this is obviously one of the implications, because how would the undeniable recognition of ETs or non-human life affect Christianity, Judaism, and Islam? So that's looking at the religious aspects of this. How would it impact those beings? Now, I'm Christian. I don't think it has much of an impact at all. In fact, I told someone I think it probably would drive more people back to church if they realized there was other beings out in the universe.
Yeah, no, I would hope so.
Yeah, but
that's a good advertisement.
People always talk about the collapse of the of religion and the collapse of our financial systems, and that's why this is all being kept secret. I think that might be a part of it, but I don't think that's the real reason. I think the only reason this has been kept secret for 70 years or more is because of the national security implications of it. If these beings that are coming here are doing so by manipulating space and time, and we have been studying that since the 30s or 40s, whenever we first came upon it, that would be something we probably wouldn't want our adversaries to have a handle on. If we spend so much time trying to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of Iran and North Korea and other people, just think if they had the ability to manipulate space and time. That would be just a quantum leap ahead of manipulating energy and matter.
Also, this one question 22, what are the best practices to avoid confabulation and hypnotic regressions? Boy, we sure could have used that a long, long time ago.
Yeah, that's always been the big curse of hypnosis, is
right,
that people say, well, but this is something they're recalling from a quieted state, which is a good way to recall things. But could it also be confabulating? Could they be making it up in their minds? That's a real tough one. I mean, my own sighting with my brother was a daylight sighting. We were very much awake, and it all happened there. But yet so many people report things that they remember later through hypnosis and through hypnotic regression. So that doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just means people tend not to take it as valid as if it were a daylight sighting or even an evening sighting where they're wide awake.
I'm sure you've given a great deal of thought as to when you had that first experience, as to whether or not, what was the meaning of it in regards to your present life? I mean, what it seems like is it had a great deal to do with where you wanted to focus your energy for your lifetime.
Yeah, I think there was a purpose to it. I think the purpose was to show me unequivocally that these things are real and that they're here and they represent advanced technology that we need to be mindful of. I can honestly say I doubt I would be doing what I'm doing today if I hadn't had that experience, and yet I have great respect for people like Dr. Robert Wood, John Schussler, and others who've been involved in this thing for 60-plus years or more, and they themselves have never had a sighting. Mm-hmm. And so I scratch my head and I think, gosh, how could you be so fervent about this, but you've never actually seen anything yourself? And what it means is that they've talked to enough people and folks who've seen it, that they're firmly convinced themselves that it's real. And I can tell you, it is real. We all know it's real. Those of us on this side know that it's real. We've got a big job ahead of us trying to get the other 7 billion people on this planet up to speed on what's going on, and hopefully in a positive way.
Well, you are doing it in a positive way. That's one of the major reasons why over the past 30-some years we've had so many of MUFON members or MUFON people that have been involved in MUFON for a long time, because I saw them as basically the real, it's going to sound corny to you, but the real savior from the standpoint of intelligence in regards to this keeping people from just getting into the emotional aspect of it and then prognosticating this, that, these, and those. That's what's gotten so has messed up so many different areas and so many people. But this last question here, are non-human intelligence here to issue some warning? What do you think of that one?
Well, it's interesting because we just finished a 2-year study, Kathleen Martin and her team, of taking a number of these non-human entity reports that we've gotten over the years to determine, what's the key messages. And there's really 2 or 3 key messages. The first one is, you're destroying your planet. Stop it, particularly with nuclear weaponry and things like that. I mean, basically we're being warned off of that. And from the cases we've had, Maelstrom Air Force Base and others, where they've come and shut off our nuclear weapons, that this is of some concern to these beings, whoever they are, wherever they're from. The other is just that we need to treat each other better. We just, Stanton used to like to say our favorite pastime on this planet is killing each other. I'm not sure he said it quite that way, but that was basically what he was saying, and he's right. I mean, yeah. We spent an inordinate amount of time just treating each other horribly, and I think these beings are trying to say, hey, no, you can't do that. You need to take care of your fellow man. You need mm-hmm. to, without getting too weepy about it, but I mean, you've got to do better than this. So the planet is a living organism. We've got to take care of it. It's been entrusted to us, and we've got to treat each other better. Those would be the two big takeaways.
Yeah, I agree. In my opinion, I'm biased here. I think prayer is extremely important. Meditation certainly has been important to my life and certainly probably in yours. But then serving and helping other people, I think that is going to be, we've got to do that. We've got to do that right away. We can't push
Absolutely.
It off because if we don't, we're going to lose it. Oh, Jan. The time is gone.
I try to do what I can to help other people.
Yeah, Dan, the time went so fast. Thank you for joining us, Jan. Of course, we're obviously going to ask you to come join us in the future, and I hope you have a good evening.
Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate being on, and I really appreciate you having me back.
Well, please hang on the line. All right. All right, friends. Zohara Hieronymus, Dr. Zo Hieronymus, will be joining you next week on 21st Century Radio.
You got to spread the word.
Stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.